It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Sometimes it is anyone's guess what candidates for public office would actually do if they're elected. But in the race for Wisconsin governor, voters have been given more than 120 examples of what they can expect. They're all bills that passed the Republican-dominated state legislature, only to be vetoed by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. As Sean Johnson reports, those bills and many more could become law if Republican challenger Tim Michaels wins in November.
Tony Evers vetoed a total of 126 bills in the last two-year session of the legislature. Since Wisconsin became a state in 1848, no governor has vetoed more bills in a single session. Included on this list were bill after bill that would have made changes to Wisconsin election laws, including by adding hurdles to voting absentee. These were top priorities for GOP lawmakers, and at a September campaign rally, Tim Michaels tells Republican voters they'll be priorities for him.
We are going to take those bills that Tony Evers vetoed. We're going to get them right. I'm going to sign them.
It wasn't just election bills that Evers rejected. He vetoed gun bills, including one that would have proclaimed that any federal bans on assault weapons don't apply in Wisconsin. He vetoed bills that would have chipped away at the safety net, like a plan to trim unemployment benefits down from 26 weeks to as little as 14. At the same rally, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss makes reference to all of them.
It's going to happen, and I promise you, when we are here in 1 year with Governor Michaels, every single thing that Governor Evers has vetoed is going to be considered by the legislature, and hopefully all of it becomes law because we are back to being the conservative, revolutionary place that Wisconsin was under Governor Walker.
This riles up Republicans. With one election, by winning this one race for governor, a full-speed-ahead conservative agenda could be theirs. But it also means Democrats see Evers as essential to blocking that agenda. Republican lobbyist Bill McCoshin worked for former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. Even though the former governor had a record of working with both parties, McCoshin said Thompson would brag about the Democratic policies he stopped in order to motivate GOP voters.
It shows the strength of the office and why the office is important. So highlighting that, there's no downside to that, at least in my opinion, and Tommy proved that. You can be out there saying, listen, I stopped all these bad things that you, my base, are against. And that's why you need to fight hard to reelect me.
On the campaign trail, Evers is soft-spoken, low-key. During a recent campaign stop at the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, Evers asks student supporters, politely, to get out and vote.
And please vote for yours truly, a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm always going to be a Badger. Thank you.
His speech here talks about what he's for, including education funding and legalized marijuana. He doesn't talk about vetoes, but in this crowd, he doesn't have to. People say Evers' veto power is part of the reason they're supporting him. Grant Hall, a sophomore studying computer science and data science, worries about the election bills Republicans would sign without Evers.
And I feel like it'll prevent a large number of Wisconsin voters from being able to go out to the polls and have their voice heard.
Rihanna Mukherjee, a senior at the UW-Madison majoring in political science, says that without Evers, Republicans would have too much control.
I think in a democracy you need balancing voices, and our Republican legislator doesn't balance voices.
In an interview after his speech, Evers says his vetoes reflect his value system, and people know that.
Part of my job going forward, again, the next 4 years will be to be that goalie and prevent bad legislation from becoming law.
And if he's not governor, Evers thinks those bills will be passed and signed as quickly as possible. In the contentious race for governor, it's one issue where Evers and Republicans seem to agree. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now, petflation. It is a thing as prices soar all around us to levels not seen in 40 years. We focus on our pets when budgets are stretched thin. According to the industry publication Pet Age, breaking down federal data, in August and September, petflation accelerated, especially in pet food, and veterinary care. Did you notice? Join in on money-saving tips and caring for pets, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Julia Bates is a board-certified veterinarian in small animal internal medicine at Madison Mobile Veterinary Specialists. Dr. Bates, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So we're going to work our way through all aspects of having a pet and starting with vet bills, because a national animal advocacy group says dog owners pay roughly $400 for annual routine medical care and prevention. Cat owners pay about $300 each year. How does a vet clinic determine and set service and procedure pricing?
Great question. You know, a lot of it comes down to what they have to pay their providers. I mean, they're, you know, where they get medications and drugs and supplies, their suppliers. And a lot of the suppliers' costs have gone up. You know, they've added surcharges for fuel. You know, so those costs have risen significantly. Wages have gone up, which, you know, it's good. I mean, staff wages need to go up, but wages have gone up, you know, paying for buildings, all of those things play into that and cost. You know, it's a pretty uniform, I would imagine, that costs amongst most clinics are somewhat similar. You're going to have a little bit of variation, but most clinics face the same thing of having, you know, the costs associated with supplies. The harder part is really for the little guys, like the ones that are not corporately owned. So a lot of clinics are being taken over by big corporations. So in those places, they get better pricing, you know, just like pharmacies get better pricing on drugs. But a lot of those are fixed costs, which you just really can't get around, unfortunately.
You hit on something I really wanted to ask you, because some in the vet industry say going to these larger chains, these large chain vet clinics, that they can hold down prices by using their size to leverage lower prices for supplies and you know, and medicines for pets. Are there prices, you know, do you see that? Have you noticed that at all?
That I don't know the answer to, but I know that a lot of the corporates, they're not necessarily owned by veterinarians, so it's very profit driven as opposed to being patient centric.
Vet clinics are labor intensive, as you mentioned. Do clinics increase costs to keep up with the cost of their staff and keeping vet tech salaries and veterinarian salaries competitive in these times when they're trying to keep staff?
And you have to. I mean, right now there is a shortage of staff available for, you know, every clinic that I go to. Everybody is looking for staff. And, you know, they're always asking me, oh, do you know anybody who's looking? Because everybody is short staffed right now. And, you know, that adds to the stress of everything. But yeah, I mean, you know, techs deserve to be paid more. But it does increase the cost of veterinary care.
If a pet owner is struggling to pay for vet care or for an upcoming procedure, what would you recommend? What are their options?
That's a great question. You know, pet insurance is something to consider. The tough part about pet insurance is that once you have a problem diagnosed, it's too late. You know, the pet insurance isn't going to cover that. Mm-hmm. So it's best to think about that earlier. You know, another option would be to put aside, you know, money every month into a savings account, you know, to save that money for pet care. And, you know, but it helps, the insurance would be something to consider, but again, think about it early. And the younger the pet is when you purchase the insurance, obviously the more affordable it is.
Do clinics typically give out their price menu for services like exams and vaccines and blood work if they're asked to do it? How does that transparency work?
But clinics are happy, you know, at least the clinics that I've been in, they're always happy that if you call, they will tell you, you know, what the costs are. But to, you know, unlike a restaurant, it's not posted on the door. Mm-hmm. And the hardest part is if someone is asking for something, if you're not asking for the right thing, that you may it's hard to know what you need. If it's just vaccines, that's easy, right? Oh, what does it cost to get a rabies vaccine? Oh, it's $35, or plus you need an exam, which is, you know, 60 or whatever it costs. But if it's something, you know, more advanced or like some sort of surgery, that may be more difficult to predict unless it's a routine thing like a spay or a neuter.
Right, because when your pet needs a pricier procedure, it's not like you want to shop around for the clinic that will provide the best value, because what if that clinic requires their own set of x-rays or their own set of lab work? You know, do you have insights on when you want to get comparisons and yet you want to still stay with your doctor and your veterinarian?
I think one of the best things that you can do is just be honest, you know, and people are understandably, you know, nervous to say, oh my gosh, I can't really afford that. But I think if people can have that conversation with their vet, you know, their vet is going to try to advocate for them. So, and do the best they can. But if as a veterinarian, you know what you're working with, it's easier to make recommendations and be able to say, hey, okay, this is the optimum thing, but, and you need to know that this is the optimum thing, but here are some other things that we can do that don't cost as much. And as long as you're making an informed decision, it's a reasonable one.
Wisconsin veterinarian Julia Bates is here on how to think about pet care in difficult financial times. Join in with ideas on how you have saved on pet care costs, questions you have about changes you made in what you buy for your pet. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we discuss petflation, pet owners can expect to spend more on all sorts of pet products and services, food, treats, toys, vet care bills, as we've been talking about. Join in on managing rising costs with inflation and pets. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have veterinarian Julia Bates, who stays with us. So, Julia, you have said that pet meds and prescriptions purchased through a vet clinic are typically more expensive. Why is that?
It's because the big pharmacies, I mean, they can get much better pricing just because of their size and volume. But there are some ways to combat that and support your local veterinarian as well. There are online pet pharmacies. A lot of clinics have online pet pharmacies in which the costs are similar to what you can get from other online pharmacies like Chewy.com or, you know, 1-800-PetMeds. But you can support your local clinic as well and get better pricing. I mean, what goes into pricing in the clinics too is that medication has to sit on the shelf. And so medications expire, you know, and so all of those things, the cost that you buy it for, plus having to shelve it and monitor it and inventory it and count it all out, I mean, all of that, you know, costs money and adds up. But I would recommend looking and asking your vet if they have an online pharmacy and try to support that.
Terry from Nina called, couldn't stay with us. And Terry wants to know, Dr. Bates, if automatic Lyme disease tests are worth the cost. Terry recently paid a lot for the test and wants to know if it was worth the cost.
An automatic Lyme disease. I wonder if he's talking about screening tests. So oftentimes there's something called a 40X, which tests for tick-borne diseases, which Lyme is one of them. And so as a screening test, it helps us evaluate whether or not there have been exposure to ticks, which then can expose to other significant diseases. So from that perspective, from a preventative type stance, yes. But if the pet is otherwise doing well, would it be unreasonable to request to put that off until a later time? You know, sure. Mm-hmm. There's no right or wrong. It's making an informed decision. And I think the more that you talk to your veterinarian about your concerns and financial concerns, the better they can help you make informed decisions.
What about putting off flea and tick meds during winter months as a way to save? What should people think about flea and tick control?
Good question. So when the ground is frozen, you know, tick medications are not needed as much. The season for ticks is getting longer and longer. Like right now, it is height of tick season. You know, and because the weather and climate is changing, I mean, we're seeing more ticks in Wisconsin, like types of ticks that we didn't see before. And so that is increasing the risk of tick-borne diseases. And I can tell you preventing them is much less expensive than treating for them in some cases. Like there's a, like one of the diseases that we see a lot in Wisconsin is called leptospirosis, and it is a bacteria that is everywhere. And we see it more in the fall and in the spring. And it can be life-threatening and it can be really expensive to treat, whereas a $35 vaccine, you know, can help prevent it.
Prevention going a long way there. Talking about ways pet owners can save money as inflation increases, Dr. Julia Bates is a Madison-based veterinarian, board certified in small animal internal medicine. You can join in money-saving tips, questions you've made, changes to your pet care in these times, 800-642-1234. Victor in Amherst has a question. Victor, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I do something that's a little bit maybe counterintuitive, and I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but I have an older dog. He's like 13 and a half, actually a little older than that now, but I the counterintuitive part is that I buy really expensive dog food that's really, really good. It's grain-free, and then I supplement some raw food, but less of that. And then I run him. He's 13 and a half, and he's still going on 10, 12, 13, you know, half marathon runs with me, just
wow.
Training runs. And he's still doing that. And it's just, you know, amazing. And it keeps him out of the vet, I think, office. You know, he goes in for regular checkups, and they're always amazed. So his name is Marley.
What breed is Marley, Victor?
I think, you know, I need to get one of those Embark things, DNA test, but I think he's a pointador.
Okay.
Yeah, so he doesn't have that classic, you know, hip dysplasia prone, you know, physiology, I guess. So.
Well, thank you for describing him. Dr. Bates, you know, a grain-free dog food and really running the dog. What are your insights there?
Well, one, congratulations on Marley having such a wonderful, long-lived life. We have to be really careful with grain-free diets. I mean, we're unfortunately seeing a lot of disease associated with them, especially grain-free diets that contain peas and lentils. Mm-hmm. We've been seeing dogs develop significant heart disease. So it's really important to talk to your vet about the food that you've gotten, and not all dogs it's going to happen to. And I'm really happy that Marley hasn't had any problems. And he mentioned an expensive food. I would say that really that is somewhere people can save money as well is, you know, just because it's the most expensive food doesn't make it the best. I've always said to my clients that the food that's best for your dog is the one that they do the best on. And I was really happy when a paper came out that supported what I had been saying. And, you know, it's not necessarily feeding a food like Old Roy, but, you know, my dogs, you know, eat Purina and they do very well on it. I personally have tried some of the more expensive diets and my dogs got really gassy and it just was not a nice place to be. So they do much better on what some people might consider a low grade food. But I think it's, you know, I think it's a very good food. And, you know, so that might be another way to save some money as well.
Is there anything we should watch out for, though, in terms of fillers or other ingredients that maybe some dogs won't do well with?
Good question. You know, there's a lot of owners believe that their dogs are allergic to chicken, which is the protein that most foods are based off of. But the reason those foods are based, their primary ingredient is chicken, is it tends to be the least allergenic. Hmm. And that's why that protein is selected. You know, it's about fillers. Good question. I'm not really a nutritionist, so it's hard to say. I do recommend avoiding diets with peas and lentils, though, because we do know that that those can potentially lead to other problems down the road.
We only have a few seconds left, but doggy daycare costs can be really high for pet owners. Are there any substitutes for taking your dog to daycare?
You know, some people are really lucky and can take their dog to work or, you know, or maybe coming home for lunch, you know, saving money by coming home from lunch and not eating out and taking your dog for a walk, or maybe having someone come in and walk your dog through the day can, you know, be less expensive as well.
Dr. Bates, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Julia Bates is with Madison Mobile Veterinary Specialists. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.